Next case is 08-1205, Cleveland Metropolitan Bar Association versus Kenneth Podor. Ms. Mandel.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, I'm Ellen Mandel on behalf of the Cleveland Metropolitan Bar Association, and with me today is Brian Riley. The issue before the Court today is whether a knowing violation combined with a conscious effort to deceive the disciplinary authority by an attorney with a prior disciplinary record is sufficiently addressed by a stayed suspension and a requirement for six CLEs in law office management. And the relator maintains that it is not. The facts in this case are straightforward and undisputed. The respondent, Mr. Podor, has a personal injury law practice. He also maintained a corporation called IMMI, which was a marketing arm. He marketed his services as a lawyer and also some unrelated diet and healthcare products. He represented a client, actually two clients, a married couple, who were injured in a personal an automobile accident and suffered some fairly grievous injuries. During the course of that representation, he sequentially doled out to them in $1,500 to $2,000 increments a total of $19,800. That money was only repayable if they were successful in their litigation. Ultimately, they were successful to the tune of about $250,000. It was a significant case, and the money was repaid. During the period of time that this was going on, Mr. Potter's secretary, Ms. Stolman, inquired about the propriety of doling out this money, and she was advised that if anybody asked, this money was being paid to the client in exchange for her services appearing in one of his television commercials. When approached by the investigator and ultimately by the trial committee in this particular case, Mr. Potter's response was that these payments were made solely as compensation for the appearance of the client, one of the clients, in the television commercial. In his answer to the first amended complaint, paragraph 10, he stated, Potter denies that the IMMI periodically, advanced funds to his clients and admits that IMMI advanced funds to Carla White, who was an independent contractor of IMMI, a friend of Podor, and a client of Podor and Associates. When he was deposed shortly before the trial of this matter, he repeated over and over again that, in fact, these payments were compensation for Ms. White's appearance in the television commercials. He acknowledged that the only other person appearing in the commercial was his own wife, and she wasn't compensated for her appearance in the commercial. She was paid by his law firm $1,500 a quarter, I think, or $3,000 a quarter on a regular basis. That Ms. White appeared for 10 seconds in the television commercial sitting in her wheelchair, and that this compensation was solely for that purpose. Well, that was clearly untrue because, in fact, the compensation was reimbursable to the law firm on the successful completion of her case. When we appeared at trial, Mr. Podor began to change his tune, I think realizing, of course, that his position was inconsistent since it was compensation on the one hand, but a loan on the other hand. So he initially testified at trial that he, in fact, was advancing this money to his client because she needed the money. She was in desperate straits. However, when pressed at length by one of the trial panel members, he reverted to his old story that this was, in fact, compensation for her appearance in the television commercials.
Counsel, is it possible, there's not a discussion of the merits of the underlying claim. Is it possible that he was going to have it both ways here, that if the client's claim turned out to be unproductive from a financial standpoint, that he would simply leave this as it appeared on his books as an expense for talent, write it off his taxes, or have it as a legitimate business deduction on the taxes of the production firm?
Well, how he intended to treat it in that particular circumstance wasn't explored on the record. I imagine that's how he would do it. Since IMMI was a corporate entity and had taxes and expenses, and he was running this through the books. And in fact, the repayment by the clients, ultimately in the distribution sheet on the personal injury case, the repayment was made back to IMMI. The problem with Mr. Potter's position is that it's inconsistent with the disciplinary rule. And historically, this court has had trouble with the 5103 violation, starting back in 1992 with the Leiserman case, which was factually a little bit distinct. The court raised some questions about whether or not this whole prohibition against champerty and maintenance, but more the maintenance side, was an appropriate avenue for sanctions. And Justice Moyer, in his dissenting opinion, in that case, indicated that, you know, so long as it remained a rule in the disciplinary rules, it was sanctionable.
Counsel, I assume once you're into one of these, the disciplinary counsel has the ability to take a look at the lawyer's books to determine whether this has been a regular practice or this is an isolated incident.
Well, we attempted to do that. Mr. Potter's practice, however, was to, almost immediately after the close of a case, the resolution of a case, destroy the files. So while it appeared likely from Ms. Stolman's testimony and the information she provided that it probably was a regular occurrence, it was not something that we could demonstrate.
And you have no ability to look at the files of the production company?
We had some records that were produced ultimately from the production company, but nothing that we could determine.
Okay.
This court has then, subsequent to the 1992 decision in Leiserman, explored this issue again in the Nussbaum case, and Justice Stratton commented that a public reprimand would be an appropriate sanction only because this rule, which clearly troubled the court, was still a rule. And the court invited, obviously, a reexamination. I have to assume that the court has reconciled its concerns because the rules of professional conduct, Rule 1.8E, which was only recently adopted, maintains the same prohibition against clients loaning money to their against lawyers loaning money to their clients. And it states in its commentary to the rules the three reasons why. One, that to allow this creates an atmosphere of competition among lawyers to secure the more lucrative cases and to fight over clients. Two, to encourage clients actually to solicit loans from their lawyers. And three, to create a conflict between the lawyer and the client because the lawyer would then have an interest independent of the litigation expenses with respect to the client's case. And so, given all of that, Mr. Potter's conduct is indefensible. And he was aware that it was indefensible because he created this elaborate story, which was not believable, but was elaborate nonetheless, as to why these payments were made to Carla White. And then when confronted with it, he lied, then he started to tell the truth, and then he reverted back to his lie.
Ms. Mandel, how did this come to the attention of the Bar Association to begin with?
The secretary. The secretary had some disputes. There were a number of other accounts that ultimately were dismissed or unproven simply because of the lack of ability to look at all the other files that the secretary told us about, but she brought it to us. And clearly, the relationship between the secretary and Mr. Podor isn't a good one. But nonetheless, what she told us was absolutely true, and ultimately we determined, looking at the distribution sheet, which was an exhibit before the panel, that in fact these payments were made, these advances were made. Mr. Podor did not submit Ms. White as a witness. There were no letters of character and fitness submitted. So unlike Leiserman, where a number of clients had come in and testified that they were in desperate straits, and in Nussbaum, where the client was having multiple surgeries and had no place to live, there was no such evidence produced on respondents' behalf. And I'd like to address the reason that the relator feels so strongly that this is an insufficient sanction is because it really does very little to discourage this kind of conduct in the future. We believe that the only way to discourage this conduct, not just by this attorney, but by other attorneys, is to actually sanction them with actual time off, actual time where they can't participate in the profits of their law firm, actual time where they are not practicing law. The sanction, as recommended by the board, which is a 12-month state suspension and CLEs, is really no punishment at all for Mr. Podor. He has to take CLEs anyway, as do the rest of us. It simply, in this case, defines that six of his CLE hours have to be in law office management. He may not find that particularly interesting, but it's not a punishment as far as I can see. And the state suspension doesn't prevent him from participating in the profits of his law firm. We believe that an actual suspension is required. And if there are no other questions, I'd like to reserve the remaining portion of my time. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Mandel. Mr. Rattigliano.
Mr. Justice, my name is Joe Rattigliano. I represent the respondent, Kenny Podor, in this action. I'll be very brief. In regards to records supplied to the relator, the relator's investigator received checkbooks from Mr. Podor's practice going back for years. I personally believe they sat in his office and they weren't looked at. I still have them in my office. This case starts out with a multifaceted complaint. It's 12, 14 allegations in a letter by a bitter former employee. By the time it gets to trial, two counts go to the panel. One count is found no violation, and the count that we are here to today, he was found to have violated. The issue here is not what he did there. What he did there is admitted. He had a private corporation. He had that corporation lend his friend, Carla White. Key aspect of this case, friend. There was an existing relationship between these two people prior to the attorney-client relationship. His friend comes to him and she needs money because she is injured and cannot work.
Counsel, did he lend the money to her prior to her contacting him for legal services?
No, Your Honor. No, Justice, she did. He did not. It was, he had represented her in the past. He was representing her at the time she asked him for additional money. There is no evidence in the record to indicate that she had needed money prior to this accident, which put her in the position of not working and needing money. But it was during the pendency of the litigation, and the only evidence that we have is the only loan that was made was during that pendency of litigation. The loan was made from a corporation. The loan was made interest-free. There's no suggestion in the record that he had any loss of objectivity or professionalism in representing the client. The panel heard him testify and so found that he lacked dishonest motive. He had no maliciousness at all in this regard. They got a problem with his statement of his motivation. Lawyers like to see things in black and white. You sit here today to reach a decision. You will decide something. Life, in my opinion, does not work that way. When someone comes to me that I have known for 25 years and asks me to borrow money, I would give him money under that circumstance. I have done that to people who were in need. Here's the money. If you make it, I want it back. If you don't worry about it. That is something that does happen amongst people who know each other. It just does. Does the rule prohibit him as a lawyer from doing it? We said it did. We admitted that it did. Is it a marginal case? I suggest that it is. I suggest this is a difficult rule for a practitioner. You have to sit in your office, and I have, and have people come in your office who can't pay their mortgage, who can't buy their prescriptions, who cannot get their medical bills. I believe counsel's response will be, we'll send them, that there are people out there who will fund. Justices, you have looked at those arrangements. They're terrible. You want to call, we'll talk about predator lending? Go to a pre-settlement funding institution, and you're going to find predatory lending. I could not send my client to a predatory lender. That would be unethical. So I'm faced with a choice. Get the money somewhere, but I can't give it to you. Or, you're a friend of mine for 25 years, should I give it to you? That's what happened in this case. His inconsistencies in testimony went to his motivation. We admitted every salient fact of this ethics violation in our letter, in our first answer, in our amended answer. His testimony must be viewed in light of that. We admitted the salient facts. He was not trying to go around those facts. He was trying to explain a situation in legal terms that arose from something other than a legal relationship, per se, or exclusively.
Did he not indicate that the payment to her was for her appearance in these TV commercials or whatever they were?
He testified at one point that it was for the TV commercials. Looking at it from an IMMI standpoint, that's what IMMI, when IMMI writes the check, it treats it as a payment to her. And I am assuming, I have not seen the tax return, this is a business deduction. He was not explaining away the violation, Mr. Justice. That wasn't admitted. He was talking about the penumbra of the violation itself, the surrounding circumstances, not the heart of the action.
It'd be a business deduction, I guess, if she indeed appeared in the commercials, but it wouldn't be if he loaned her the money, would it, to help her in her lawsuit?
I have a little.
There'd be a different tax treatment, wouldn't there? Whether he was paying her for appearing in a commercial, which was the business of IMMI, or whether she was being paid to help her in her suit.
I understand the question. It is a different transaction. This is an ethical case, not a legal case. We're not here to decide the tax treatment of that payment. We're here looking at that payment that was made through a corporation that he owned to a client that he represented. Those facts were admitted. The rule itself, when you read the rule and you read the ethical considerations under it, do not blanket prohibit this activity. It speaks as generally may not happen. EC7, I believe, EC8 under 5. It says exceptions do exist, talking about the expenses, witness fees, etc. We never fought the violation. There was only explanation around it. His inconsistencies in testimony, I would suggest to the court, must be looked at in terms of what had happened before. What had happened before was an admission of the facts, the specific facts necessary to find him guilty of that ethical violation. I have nothing further. I'd ask that the judgment below be affirmed. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Bertigliano. Ms. Mandel, you saved almost 4 minutes of your time.
Thank you, Your Honor. In the respondent's answer to the original complaint, not the first amended complaint, with respect to this particular allegation, Mr. Podor admitted to making loans, and I quote, to a very few friends of his who happened also to be clients. That was his answer at paragraph 13 to the original complaint. So that we know that he's done this on more than one occasion. And then at his deposition, he stated categorically, absolutely, and without exception, that this was payment for appearance in the television commercial. And then we get to trial. And I quote at length in our relator's brief at page 4-6, the whole colloquy that went on, that it was in part for the commercial and in part for the injury.
pretty much made that clear that he's changed his story a couple different times. So really the issue that you have is that you feel like the fact that he changed his story merits the higher sanction, not the fact that he gave the loan. Is that what you're saying?
In part, Your Honor. But I would also like to comment on...
Because he did admit to giving the loan. He did admit to the violation, correct?
Ultimately, he did.
Did you get an initial letter admitting that he...
No. The initial letter was that these were loans and or to a few friends and or payment for the television commercial. It wasn't all that clear.
Okay. So your objection is the fact that you feel like he wasn't straightforward, admitted right up straight that he was loaning her because she was in an auto accident and needed help.
That's correct. Okay. And I think it's very clear that he knew that he had done something quite wrong. I would also like to submit that since this court has now reconciled whatever dispute it had with the underlying theory behind 5103B by adopting 1.8E, that it's no longer appropriate that a public reprimand should be the baseline for this particular violation, especially in a case, as we have here, where we have an attorney with a prior disciplinary record, where he has admitted in his initial answer to the complaint that he's done this more than once, although the files were not available in the distribution.
Well, I just looked at his prior discipline case. It wasn't the greatest sin ever committed by a
lawyer, it wasn't,
by any stretch of the imagination. And it's one that I suspect a lot of lawyers that handle these kinds of cases maybe get close to the edge on in terms of negotiating a reduced payment to a medical provider that's making a claim against the fee or against the pot of money that results from a personal injury settlement. You said in answer to Justice Stratton's question that his original letter indicated this was a combination of loan and payment for talent. Did I misunderstand you?
You didn't, and it wasn't that direct. It was a story about I made loans to a few clients, she was in my television commercial, from which we had to glean.
So he was vague about the purpose
of
the payment to begin with.
And my purpose for raising his prior discipline isn't because he committed the greatest sin in the world 10 years ago. It's because he was aware that honesty and forthrightness to the disciplinary system is absolutely mandatory. And having gone through it once before, should have known better. So starting out with a public reprimand as your baseline in this particular case, I think, is inappropriate. But we maintain that the only way to stop this practice, which I believe is probably a lot more apparent, a lot more unapparent than is actually occurring, is to make an actual suspension the appropriate sanction in this case. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Mandel. The case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion.